Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. My guest, Dr. Michael Hudson. Our topic, our national debt, and what has the Democratic Party really become in looking at the information and the facts. And that's what he's going to do. How will this impact all of us? My guest is one of our nation's finest and most important economists and Wall Street financial analyst. Dr. Paul Craig Roberts has called Michael the world's best economist. He is the president of the Institution for the Study of Long-Term Economic Trends. He is a distinguished research professor of economics, University of Missouri. He was the chief economic policy advisor for Representative Dennis Kucinich's 2008 presidential campaign. He also served as an advisor to the White House, the State Department, Defense Departments, and he served as an economic advisor to other governments, including Iceland, Latvia, and China. He's written many books and important papers and articles, including Lending Foreclosure and Redemption from Bronze Age Finance to the Jubilee Year, which is about debt forgiveness. And also he wrote Killing the Host, How Financial Parasites and Debt Bondage Destroy the Global Economy, that addresses the cause and effect behind the polarization of the 1% versus the 99%. His website is michael-hudson.com. Nice to have you with us today.
It's good to be back, Gary.
I'm going to start by citing some figures, and then I would like to see how you deconstruct what my argument is. And it's a rather complex one, but one that I never hear anyone discussing. And I think that you're the perfect person to discuss this. And it's all about debt. Now, the average person is immersed in debt, and they can do all the debt that they want, providing that they're paying exorbitant interest, usurious interest rates. In fact, payday loans and some of these other outfits out there can charge 500 to 1,000%. Seems impossible, and yet it's legal in those states that allow it. And then you look at the legislators that passed this, and why would anyone pass this debt? Then you look at the legislators, the President of the United States, two of them, who signed off on you cannot use the bankruptcy to forgive any of these student debts or some other debts. Why would they do that? If a person's already in a form of debt peonage, why would you punish someone that has nothing by adding more onto it? But that's one part of our economic system. But then comes along a proposed package for a bailout to help America get back on its feet, and the euphemisms flow forth. For example, we're going to have an infrastructure that really surpasses anything we've had since the 1950s, when Eisenhower was the one promoting a highways and the dams. So we're going to have money for high-speed rail to match that of China or Japan or Germany or France. We're going to have bridges that won't be a problem in collapsing. We're going to fix our dams and levees so we don't have natural disasters anymore. We're going to repair our roads, all of our major highways. And so people say, well, yeah, we need that. That's reasonable. And how are you going to pay for it? Well, it could be about $3.6 trillion, but not to worry, because one group says it's going to be $5 trillion, and never has the government given us a figure that's actually accurate. It's always understated and overpromised. But then, not to worry, major corporations, the very rich, are going to pay for it. We're going to increase their taxation. Okay, maybe that's good. Maybe that works. But then I'm asking, are they being financially responsible, and will they actually do something that helps the average person's quality of life, or all the people living in a given area, county, a state? Because historically, with rare exception, that has not been the case, not in the last 40 years. But then I ask, who's going to do all this work? Who's going to build the bridges? Who's going to plant millions, if not billions, of trees we need to create carbon sinks that will help hold the carbon into the ground instead of going into the atmosphere and causing global warming? And they say, not to worry. The government's not going to do any of this work. The government doesn't fight the wars. We hire private contractors. They're going to manage everything. So we're going to have a private-public partnership, and that's great because these are the best and brightest. These major corporations, whether it's Bechtel or Halliburton, these people know what they're doing. Okay, and if you doubt me, I can show you a lot of experts at the Cato Institute, the Business Roundtable, the Council on Foreign Relations, and by the thousands, they will come forward and say, these people can solve America's problems. And by the way, don't worry about global warming, and that's also being funded. We have the tech titans out there in Silicon Valley, and they're going to come up with technological advances, so you don't really have to change anything. You don't have to give up your meat. You don't have to give up your cell phones. You don't have to give up anything. In fact, actually consume more. We've got you covered. Good. Hey, the average American would love not to change anything. They love change. They just don't want to be it. So then we get to the base of this, the progenitor. We have debt. We have personal debt, city debt, state debt, corporate debt, federal debt. We have all this debt, but no one's talking about that debt. The current gross domestic product, that means the total income coming in, is $22.8 trillion. Now, we said in 2008 that Greece and Ireland and Italy and France were financial basket cases because their debt, the amount they owed compared to what they were bringing in, was 140 to almost 200%. And therefore, austerity. Major changes. In Greece, for example, they cut people's pensions nearly in half. So where they were able to retire from their public service and live comfortably, but not extravagantly, now they were out there looking for anything that was a bargain or a deal because they couldn't even survive. But too bad. Now, who benefited from that? Private corporations. Which corporations? The same ones that are always involved in private-public deals, you know, like Goldman Sachs, etc. So then today I said, okay, since we're shaming the whole world and how their economic basket cases, how well are we? What is our percentage of debt to gross domestic product? So I just did the numbers. Here's the actual numbers. These are all governmental numbers. U.S. total debt, $86 trillion. And that's adjusted with $2.5 trillion for the stimulus. That means it's $89.5 trillion. Let's round it off because we know it's not going to be $3.5 trillion. It'll be at least another $500 million. So let's just say $90 trillion. $90 trillion the U.S. government owes. That's the total debt. The national debt is $28 trillion. Adjusted for the $3.5, it's $31.5 trillion. The state debt is $1.2 trillion. Local debt is $21.1 trillion. And then you look at the debt to foreign countries and unfunded liabilities. And that is $199 trillion, with a T, trillion, $199 trillion. So what is our gross domestic product percentage to debt? 904%. Let me repeat that. 904%. Why have we never seen this? Why is no economic forecasting publication, the business channels, on CNN or any of the other networks, why aren't they telling you we are the most bankrupt country in the world? We can never pay this off. We can't even pay a percentage of that off. In fact, the total interest paid, $3.9 trillion. Total personal debt, $21.4 trillion. So Americans are totally swamped in debt. The mortgage debt, $15.8 trillion. Student debt, $1.7 trillion. Credit card debt, $958 billion. Social Security liability, $21.3 trillion. U.S. unfunded liability, $151 trillion, Medicare liability, $33 trillion, currency and credit derivatives, $72 trillion, U.S. debt held by foreign countries, $7.1 trillion, U.S. debt for imported oil, $209 billion. So then you have to ask, what is corporate debt? $9.9 trillion. So everywhere I look, and when I'm looking at actual figures and bringing them together and joining the pieces together, I'm asking, how in the world did all of this escape any public scrutiny, debate, or discussion? Why are these figures not important to anyone, anywhere? And the only thing it is driven is promising the public something that I know will never be delivered. And that is what's going to come when they say yes to everything, and then the special interests come in and eat this alive, as they've done with everything else. Michael, that's the larger issue that I want to address. And I've laid it out. I'm sorry it took so long, but I wanted to get all my thoughts in there. So now you can take your time and show what we are looking at and what you see, how we got there, and how by just doing more of the same is anything fundamentally going to change when a society has 36 million hungry people every day, Americans hungry, going to bed food insecure. They don't have enough food for them. Not a single thing being done. And people now being thrown out of their apartments or homes because they have to pay their landlord and they don't have the money. Millions, nothing being done. Businesses closing because they haven't paid the rent for the last year and a half. Now they're being forced out and they're going to go broke. Nothing being done. And then we look and say, well, what are we actually doing? The form is yours.
Well, you've tied a number of things together, and the best thing for me to do is to take them part by part, beginning with how you begin, with what's really your big picture. Who is going to be building this infrastructure? And is the government going to be doing it? No. You pointed out that private companies are going to be doing it. Well, I think people miss how important this distinction is. In the 19th century, there was a long discussion in America's business schools and in politics about why a government should itself provide basic infrastructure like education and basic needs, public health, and even transportation. And the reason is the government infrastructure is like an independent factor of production. You have labor, you have capital, but you also have public infrastructure. Well, the public infrastructure has a different purpose than private capital investment. If you are a private company, like a railroad company or a road builder, you want to make a profit and you want to make capital gains and you want to use the profits to push up the stock. And if you have a infrastructure monopoly, infrastructure means it's a natural monopoly, like a cable TV, like electricity. You can only have one provider in a given region, like you mentioned high-speed transportation. Well, if you have a private developer, then they're going to try to make as much money as they can, as much profit, and even over and above profit, they have a monopoly rent that they'll charge. So the more private investment you have, like a private university, it's going to try to charge whatever the market will bear. And the university is going to try to raise its tuition as high as possible. And it will be helped to raise its tuition costs, like $50,000, I think, a year for NYU and Columbia University here in New York. It can get banks to say, well, we will lend students or their families the money so that they can afford to pay these high privatized publication education costs. And really, an education or health insurance is whatever a bank will lend against it, just like the price of housing will be. You can buy a house for however much the bank will lend you as a mortgage. Well, this is very different from public investment. The argument for public investment is it's not trying to make a profit. The idea of the reason why American education was provided freely and health care and welfare were provided freely is that lowers the cost of living and lowers the cost of business. And the Americans said, well, we can outproduce Europe. We can make America the most competitive country in the world. This was from the late 19th century. If we have the government provide people's basic needs at such a low cost that American workers won't have to earn a high enough wage to pay their own educational costs, to pay for their own health care, for their own basic needs. We're going to have government subsidize communications, roads, so that they won't have to pay for toll roads. We can make the cost of living so low here that the cost of hiring labor to produce industrial goods will be much lower than countries that privatize everything. And if you have a country that has privatized education, then and privatized roads and privatized water and sewage and electricity and all that, well, then all these privatized economies are going to have to let private companies come in and make monopoly profits. And that's just what happened in England after 1980 when Margaret Thatcher got in. England had been run by the Labour Party for many years and had had a very extensive public housing to lower the cost of housing so that British labour could work in making the manufacturers that made it an industrial economy. England had public railroads. It had a public telephone system. It may not have worked very well, but at least it was low priced and low cost, and England had low cost of living. Well, Margaret Thatcher came in and immediately began to privatize everything, beginning with British telephone. Telephone costs went way up. She privatized the railroads. Railway costs went way up. But most of all, she privatized housing. And instead of paying the old subsidized rates, housing costs went up maybe 10 times. And all of a sudden, workers could not afford to live in London anymore. If you had a job in London, you had to move outside of London and in a suburb and take a very expensive privatized train into London in order to get to work. And all of a sudden, England became a high-cost economy that priced itself out of world market and went into a chronic depression. The Americans looked at it and say, this is wonderful. This we can make a mint off. If we can do what Margaret Thatcher did to England and make America's economy that way, we can get rich on making our own monopolies with by privatizing our own roads. We can turn the roads into toll roads. We can turn the cable TV into monopolies and get high prices for that. We can make sure with privatizing medicine with the Obamacare, we can increase the cost of living for medicine for Americans from about 5% of the GDP to 18% of the GDP. We can make America the highest cost economy in the world. And of course, that'll mean that we're not going to be an industrial economy anymore. Wages are not going to go up. We're not going to be an equality economy, but we're the 1%. We don't want an equality economy. We can get rich by impoverishing the 99%, by getting the government out of the economy and turning everything over to Wall Street. And all we need to do is promote an idea of free markets, where a free market is one where the government doesn't do any regulation and doesn't do any investment. The government doesn't build a TVA to the Tennessee Valley Authority to provide cheap electricity. It doesn't build roads. That leaves everything to the private sector. And we can all get rich by monopolizing this infrastructure at the cost of America. It's true that most Americans are going to become very poor, and they're going to have to go into debt in order to live. We can privatize education. The universities will get rich by charging rates. When I went to New York University, I think I paid $500 a semester. Now I would have to pay $25,000 a semester. And NYU is the largest private university in the country. So all of a sudden, this became the new plan under Ronald Reagan in the 1980s, and then even much more under the Democrats under Clinton. President Clinton then deregulated banking, opened the door for or massive financial fraud that exploded in 2008. So it makes a big difference whether how this infrastructure is built and who builds it, and whether this infrastructure is built to provide low-cost services for America, which is what I think people imagine infrastructure is going to be. They imagine that, oh, it's going to be efficient, high-speed railroads, efficient medical care. All of this is going to be probably at cost. But what they don't realize is that all the government is going to take this money, and most of the infrastructure spending by the government is going to be turned over to Wall Street, to corporations that are managed by Wall Street financial managers in order to privatize. And the cost of creating this infrastructure may be $6.5 trillion, but they're going to try to charge $13 trillion or $26 trillion or however much they can force the population to pay, because once you have an infrastructure monopoly, like there's only one subway to take, there's only one educational system, there's only one internet system to use, or cable TV, or there's only one health system to use, by privatizing this $6.5 trillion, you're going to turn America into the kind of high-priced economy that wrecked England's economy in the 1980s and has been wrecking American economy as we've been privatized. So that's the first part of your discussion, the privatization versus the public management and public regulation. The second point you mention is the debt. That's actually not a problem. The U.S. government cannot go bankrupt because it can always because it owes debt, for a simple reason. It can always just print the money. If you owe debt, or a family owes debt, or a company owes debt, they can't just print the money. They have to borrow the money to repay the creditor, or else the creditor gets to foreclose on their home or their property or their savings account, or say, we're not going to give you Social Security, we're going to dock it in order to pay your student loan, or whatever. But the government can simply create its own money. It doesn't even have to tax people. We've seen, you and I have spoken before on this show, when Donald Trump slashed taxes, he said, well, we can slash taxes because the government can simply print the money. And that's exactly what it's been doing. But the government only has been printing money, basically, to pump into the stock market and the bond market and enrich the 1%. So people in this country, when they talk about the government, they don't ask, well, just who is the government working for? Is it working for the 1%? Is it working for Wall Street? Or is it working for us? I'm not sure what that sound was. And it makes all the difference when you look at who is sponsoring the politicians and lobbying them to pass the law and work out all of the details of the $6.5 trillion. Well, you're having a split right now. The Republicans, and Republicans include about half of the Democratic Party. For the last 10 years, the Democratic National Committee has been running Wall Street lobbyists and corporate lobbyists and basically Republicans as Democrats, just to make sure that if the Democratic Party, that was long associated with the working class and labor unions and ethnic minorities, just to make sure that if the Democrats are elected, they're going to have enough Republicans that no matter what, the government is not going to do any act that does not benefit the main corporate donors to the Democratic National Committee and to the leading members of the local committees. For instance, the members of the Health Committee in Congress all are financed mainly by the pharmaceutical companies. So, of course, you just had yesterday the Democrats on the health committee saying, wait a minute, we can't bargain with the drug companies to lower the cost so that we can buy drugs at the price that they can get in Canada or that even the VA administration buys. We have to let the pharmaceutical companies make a monopoly. So they've blocked the government from even regulating the privatized drug sector. So I think this is an example of the kind of infrastructure deal that may be made. The government has spent enormous amounts of money doing research to develop new drugs and new pharmaceuticals. It then gives this research freely to a corporation and lets the corporation get a patent and says you can charge whatever you want, and even if it costs 25 cents to make a drug, you can sell it at a dollar or $100 or $1,000. We're not going to bargain with you. Thank you for your campaign contribution to us. We've been able to beat our rivals. Keep the money coming. We're not going to use this research that we've financed to produce our own drugs, even though we could produce drugs at 5 cents a shot and give it to Americans. We'll let you charge a dollar, $10, however how much you want a shot. Well, that's going to be the kind of privatization that you can have both Republicans and Democrats agree on for any kind of infrastructure deal. So these are the political dynamics that are at play that make politics so dramatic in this country.
I appreciate that overview. Thank you. Now let's look at the reality of how bad these private-public efforts are and who really benefits, like when suddenly all of the parking in a city, all the parking meters in the garages, are owned by a major corporation. What happens there? And when you're on a road? I remember recently I was up around Orlando. My goodness, every several miles there was another toll booth. And it just never stopped. And, of course, someone's paying for that. The public is. But how did that happen? Who gave a lot of money to a city that needed it with the idea that we'll take over all of these responsibilities? We're going to give you some money up front, but we control this for the next 100 years. And then the kind of money that these companies make on these private partner, private relationships. Also, one good example. In Iraq, in Afghanistan, one of the GIs who'd returned there came in and I was counseling him on his health issues, and he said, you wouldn't believe it. I could go down to the local community and wash my clothes for a quarter. I could hire someone to wash a whole duffel bag of clothes for 50 cents, but they wouldn't allow that. All of your wash had to be done by a contractor, and I believe he said it was Halliburton, and it was $100 a duffel bag, $100. I mean, and he said the clothes still came out too, kind of greasy and smelly. But he said nobody would change anything, no matter how bad it was. Could you go through that part of the game that the government is playing more and more and more, turning everything over to special interest groups that lobby them and their corporate interest, and then we end up paying for it?
Well, you asked who's behind this. Well, basically, let's look at the worst example of toll roads is in Indiana. And Indiana is a right-wing Republican state, and it said, we don't believe in taxing corporations. Well, the result is that Indiana ran a budget deficit. And when a state runs a budget deficit, it's not like the government running a budget deficit. The government can print the money, but states can't print their own money. And so Indiana didn't have enough money to provide the basic needs, education, general welfare for the population. So it had to borrow money from Wall Street. And so Wall Street organized toll road companies. And so they lent the money at interest to India to build huge, huge toll roads. that they got the right to put the toll booth on. The toll booth they put in charged such high rates that most Indiana people stopped using the roads, the toll roads, and they used off roads, the roads that didn't have toll booths on them. And it took longer, but nobody could afford to pay the tolls. Same thing happened in Chicago. Chicago's a big financial as well as industrial city. It's more and more financial now than industrial. And it didn't want to tax real estate, especially it didn't want to tax the real estate owned by wealthy people, and it didn't want to tax the financial corporations in Chicago. So it ran a deficit. What was it going to do? It sold the parking meters on the right to parking meters on the street to, I think it was Goldman Sachs. That organized the whole thing. And all of a sudden, anybody who wanted to park a car in Chicago had to pay a very stiff and rising parking fee. And there was small print in the contract. And the small print said, if Chicago was going to have a block party and suspend parking because there's a party, then it has to pay Goldman Sachs company just as much as if it wouldn't have had a party. Even though nobody's parking there, it has to pay the normal rates. And if there's a snow or there's another problem, it has to continue to pay. So Chicago find itself almost going bankrupt on this privatization of that was supposed to borrow to provide Chicago with the money to bail it out for debt that was taken on by not taxing the rich, and that's why the fight in the Democratic Party now, or pretended fight, it's all really a Punch and Judy charade show, is, well, gee, how are we going to pay for the $6.5 trillion? Maybe we'll have to reverse Donald Trump's tax cuts for the rich. And there are a number of things that Biden said. Well, for one thing, in order to save money, the Internal Revenue Service has stopped hiring people to look at tax returns, and especially the tax returns that are very complicated, like the tax returns that millionaires turn in or billionaires turn in. And so they found that there's an enormous amount of fraud. Well, the Democrats' majority and the Republicans say, wait a minute, fraud is part of the free market. This is what a free market means. You can do anything you want. Of course there's fraud. That's we should celebrate our freedom. And so they're not going to increase the IRS staff. Bernie Sanders and others have pointed out, well, half of the American corporations don't pay any tax at all, any income tax at all. And shouldn't every corporation have to pay some tax? And what about corporations that don't pay tax because they pretend that they earn all of their money in the Cayman Islands or Panama or one of the offshore banking centers in a country that doesn't have an income tax? And then they say, oh, well, all this money we made in America, we make abroad, like Apple or Google pretend to make their money in Ireland that has very low 15% tax rates. So this is the argument, and basically the Democratic majority is in agreement with one thing. Okay, one way we can get all the votes, only the middle class is going to have to pay the income tax. We're not going to tax the rich more. We may raise the tax rates, but since the rich people have don't earn an income in America, they earn it abroad, this tax rate isn't going to affect most of the big corporations at all. So all of this discussion is very theoretical and abstract, and it's sort of using an Orwellian rhetoric for describing a plan in words that sound as if it's going to provide more goods and services in America and make their transportation easier and make life less expensive, when the real plan is to make life much more expensive while enriching the wealthiest 1% of the corporations and the billionaires by giving them huge monopoly rights with money that the government will lend them to build the new railroads, give them to build the new roads and make a profit on, give them to develop new healthcare systems and charge whatever they want. So you have to look at who's actually benefiting, and that's something that they don't want you to know. They want to talk about what's going to be built and not who's going to pay for it and who's going to get the profits from it, and whether the government should be getting the profits and or the private corporations.
I appreciate the insights. Thank you, Michael. Now let's turn our attention to something that really concerns me, and that is how much money we waste that is unaccounted for. It's in the trillions of dollars, according to an inspector general for the Defense Department, and also even Donald Rumsfeld once said that, this is right before 9/11, we're talking over 20 years ago, and he said that there are trillions of dollars that are unaccounted for, and from then till now, no one inside or outside the government has been able to say how much money we spend, and yet every single administration, conservative or liberal, continues to pump hundreds of billions of dollars a year into all of these military-industrial contractors, totaling trillions upon trillions of dollars now. And what do we have to show for it? Well, if Afghanistan's one good example, we have thousands of dead Americans, tens of thousands of dead Afghanistan citizens. We have a country now controlled by terrorists, and we gave them $82 billion in our military equipment. And what was it for? Now there are an alliance with China, Russia, Iran, and Pakistan. Pakistan's a terrorist state. That's where Al-Qaeda has been hiding. That's where Osama bin Laden was found. Not a single word of criticism to them for all this. And we just keep pumping money into this gigantic labyrinth, and nothing good ever comes from it. Nothing good. Could you explain that whole principle of don't ask questions, just give us your money?
Well, when money's not accounted for, it's good for somebody. But it means that if it's not accounted for, that means the government doesn't feel that it should let people know what it's being spent for, because the people wouldn't want to spend that money. So when something's when money disappears and it's not accounted for, it's called a black budget, meaning you don't see anything where it goes. And that means that it goes to government agencies. Much of it's supposed to be paid to support corrupt foreign leaders. It's supposed to pay CIA special operations. It's supposed to pay State Department bribery of foreign countries, or all sorts of things that if this were reported on a budget saying so much for bribery, so much for having an assassination team come in and shoot a leader that we don't want, so much for covert propaganda, we probably give many billions to ISIS, to the terrorists there, in order to fight against Syria and Iraq. Most Americans would not want to see this money that's pouring into ISIS be spent, because ISIS are, as you point out, a crazy terrorist group. So when the government spends money on something that people would vote it out of office for if they knew about it, then they say, well, it's just disappeared and we're not going to do an audit. Well, especially there's no audit of the military-industrial complex, because, again, they get not only a cost-plus audit, but they get to spend money pretty much any way that they want. And because they're such a big funder, and because the military-industrial complex builds factories in almost every congressional district so that it can have It's workers lobbied the local politicians to get more contracts. Well, then you're going to have a system where they get to do whatever they want. And in fact, the military, the professional military, usually puts in it the Pentagon's request to the government. And Congress almost always gives the military much more than it wants. And the military will say, wait a minute, we don't need any more F-35 fighters because they don't fly. And, you know, if we do try to fly them, they're going to crash, and really don't want them. And, the Congress will say, well, wait a minute, that, building them, employs labor, you know, in your district in America. And, we're not building this military equipment really to bomb anyone. We're building it to employ labor, and, we've got to drop it somewhere. As you know, they left, huge amounts, just in Afghanistan, And they build huge aircraft carriers, even though everyone realizes that if there's any war, the aircraft carriers will disappear in the first 5 minutes of the war. It doesn't matter. They're not building them really to fight. They're building them to spend money, and on which profits are made by the military-industrial companies. So this is crazy. Of course, all the money that's spent on the military could be spent on domestic infrastructure, but it's not, because that's not the group that controls the government. And there's really no Wall Street or business group that finds its interest in making America a low-cost economy where everybody has a job producing goods that people actually buy. They make money financially, or by getting money from the government and making goods that people don't buy, like arms that the military makes and sells to the government, or infrastructure that may or may not work that the government then privatizes and turns over to its campaign contributors. So we have a Congress that really is run by the campaign contributors. They're the one, they're the voters as far as the congressmen care about. They care about who's going to contribute to their campaign, to run the television ads, to say that everything they're doing is for the people, where they're actually promising the contributors, well, what we're doing is going to be for you, but you have to have us provide us with a rhetoric that we can tell people that making profit for you is all going to trickle down and benefit society at whole, as long as we can convince society not to look, wait a minute, what's happening to your living conditions? Are they going up or not? If you see the stock market soar and the bond market soar and all the billionaires, are you getting a better lifestyle, or are you getting further and further in debt, as you just pointed out, medical debt, insurance debt, education debt, car debt, and just personal debt, and now housing debt, now that housing prices have gone up 20% in the last year?
I want to take on another issue that's not being addressed at all. People will mention universal health care, but absolutely nothing can be done about it, even though the Democrats control both houses, the Senate, the House, and the executive branch, and the media. So I decided to take a careful look. I did an analysis. We spend about $3.7 trillion on medical care each year. So I broke it into categories. I said, how much of this actually works? And I found that over 50% does not work. Actually, a lot of the death in the United States comes from iatrogenesis, or medically induced. In fact, I wasn't the first one to do this. There were people preceding me who did it. A big professor at Harvard did it. He said that the number one cause of death in the United States is not stroke or heart attack or cancer or diabetes. It's iatrogenesis, or medically induced. I did a 5-year study with 4 PhDs and MDs, all in research sciences, and using only the statistics of medicine itself, with no opinion, no editorializing. He was right. And yet, when I look around, not a single committee anywhere in Congress, no governmental agency, not the FDA, the U.S. Public Health Service, National Cancer Institute, not the EMA, no one's saying that we should change anything. So then, okay, I said, so even though a lot of people wanted insurance to cover their health needs, what they didn't anticipate was a lot of the coverage they're getting could actually work against them. Emergency medicine is the best, It really exceeds all expectations. If you have an emergency, we're really good at helping save your life. But for chronic care, we actually are a total failure. For arthritis, for cancer, for heart disease, we don't prevent anything in this country, and we're terrible at fixing chronic conditions. As a result, we're the sickest nation in the world per population. So I did the math. We could have every single American covered for everything if we simply made the following, what would seem to be reasonable changes. Give free medical education to every doctor and nurse. When they get out of medical school and they go into internship and residency, they're not punished. They're not put on these, you know, working 22-hour days, 2 days in a row, and then they often expect to do good medicine. They can't. They're not going to be loaded with any debt. They have no debt. The tradeback is they are given a living, good living wage. Let's just make up a figure of $200,000 a year right out of medical school. So now they have no reason to be charging $50,000 for a heart operation. Then the same with the nurses. So you eliminate their debt, but also think of the 900,000 more or less doctors plus all the nurses being able to be there where greed is not the mitigating factor because they can't profit off the free economy at that point. Secondly, you take away all malpractice insurance. You have no-fault medical insurance. So a person that can be shown to have legitimately been injured by medical procedure can get covered, but they can't be getting all these trial lawyers to run in there and these mercenary and highly deplorable type of personal injury attorneys who say, "We're, you know, if you have this condition, we'll get you money." Well, most of that money goes to them. In any case, so that way it takes an enormous burden. We're talking about tens of billions of dollars a year spent in malpractice insurance. That also in turn leads to defensive medicine, which is huge, meaning instead of having one test that you need, you might have 20 tests that you don't need. They're just going to test you for everything in case they are sued. They can say, "We did all these tests." So you eliminate that. You also take the fraud out. Over $250 billion a year goes to fraud. You get rid of the fraud. You get rid of the administrative costs, which is over one-third of all the money that goes into medicine goes to the administrators. You're talking about over $1.1 trillion a year. Then you also go on to the marketplace and you give everyone producing any product that goes into the medical system a 300% markup. Now imagine that's more than fabrics, that's more than food, that's a huge markup. Now you think that that's a lot, but what if I told you the top 10 drugs, and I did the research on this, the highest percentage of profit over a 30-day supply of a generic product, the product cost 10 cents for a 30-day supply, was over $300 when it was sold to the patient. We were talking about tens of thousands of percent markup. So that puts in another around $600 billion a year into expenses that could be eliminated if we didn't allow people just to exploit the market for every procedure. A friend of mine had a stomach ache. That's it, a stomach ache. Went to an emergency room. They gave him an ice pack. They gave him a saline solution, a dollar bag of salt water they put into him, and he went home. He got a bill for $11,000. Everything they do, including not allowing you to walk out of a hospital, put you in that wheelchair to walk you to the door, they're charging you huge amounts of money. They'll charge $100 for that $1 saline solution. And now you see something, a phenomenon that's just on fire. All across America, and I've spoken with a lot of doctors, their practices are being bought by equity groups. They'll come in and they'll say, "How much are you making per year?" "Well, I'm making net." "What do you take home at the end of the year after all your expenses and overhead?" $400,000. "Okay, we're going to give you $1 million. Right up front. We're going to buy that practice for $1 million. We own it now, and we're going to give you $400,000 per year. You work for us." And then they get all these, for example, they get all the cosmetic surgeons into a group. They'll get all the neck surgeons into a group. They'll get all the gastroenterologists. So they get groups. So then when you look under the in the yellow pages, you go to that particular group, and they got everything you need there. But the prices are astronomical And that's because the group that does not have a medical license will never treat a patient, is deciding how much a patient must be charged, and then they try to tie it into insurance and Medicare or Medicaid to make sure someone's going to pay that big bill. Hence, a snake bite, true story, cost a guy $155,000. Where historically, if you were in Arizona, you got bitten by a diamondback rattler, they would give you an anti-venom, you'd stay for 2 days in the hospital, and you might get a $6,000 bill. Now it's $154,000. So the reason that this is growing crazy, and both Democrats and Republicans both have the big problem. They both support the profiteers in Big Pharma, the hospital associations, the medical groups, and now everybody that can exploit a dollar out of the system for you being sick. And nobody makes money when they prevent a disease. So everything is about treating the disease, not preventing it, and treating it, whether it works or not, whether the procedure is beneficial or not, is irrelevant. And getting you on medications for the rest of your life, that's the game. So when you look, I could see that every single American could be treated with prevention, including alternative health care involved in that, and no pressure on doctors or dentists and nurses. For $1.1 trillion a year, you could save over $2.5 trillion a year. So the public would benefit, the government would benefit, everyone would benefit, but the people exploiting you up to this point and continuing will not tolerate that. Your thoughts, please.
Well, I don't know if there are any publishers listening to your show, Gary, but I can imagine them calling you and say, Gary, no, you can write a great book, How to Make a Fortune in Medicine, great success stories. And you can describe all of these as success stories. Imagine having a hospital where you can charge, first of all, you make a deal with a helicopter company to spend $20,000 just to helicopter somebody in. You have an ambulance company that charges, say, $5,000 if you have a monopoly. When they can charge over $100,000 to fix a snake bite or other things, you could write great success stories in medicine and show how it's done. And the same thing in practice, saying you don't have to be a doctor to make $1 billion in medicine. You can, all you have to do is buy out a practice and control what tell the doctors how much to charge the patients, and then bill it to the pharmaceutical companies, in which we Wall Street firms also have a very large stock holding and bond holding interest. And you can show how this makes many people very, very, very rich. Not that many people, only 1% of the population, but enough of the people to make the rest of the population pretty poor. Now, you say that the you talk as if not fixing a disease and charging people and not fixing them is somehow a waste. It's not a waste for the companies. They want to make money. The last thing that do you know how much America GDP would go down if people stopped getting obese from sugar foods, from Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola and all of the sugar drinks? If people got healthy, you'd be cutting our GDP by 20%. And you can imagine an economist saying, well, that would be a disaster. GDP is good. GDP is trying to tell people that they're going to get well, or at least dealing with their disease. And you can't add to GDP dealing with disease unless you have a disease. So, of course, there's not going to be any money put into prevention, because that's not where the profits are. So if you're going to tell people how to make a fortune in medicine, you have to have sick people in order to make a fortune off of, and you have to have a pharmaceutical industry that is a vehicle in making this fortune, and you have to have an organization of hospitals that are run, if not for profit, then at least for the benefit of the doctors. I can see where your ideal is going. Your ideal is going back to the origins of Greek medicine and the Hippocrates on the island of Kos, and the Greek doctors. And in all early societies, doctors were just like other people. It was a profession. Same thing in Cuba. The doctors, whether they were brain surgeon or just medical doctors, don't make much more money than anyone else, and probably not as much as hotel people who change the beds in hotels, because at least they can ask the visitors for a tip, which is more than the doctors get down there. So there are two different social models for medicine. In our model, Greek Hippocrates and the other Greek doctors didn't have an organization like the American Medical Association advocating for, hey, here's how you can use your control over health, or what people believe is your control over health, to get rich. Well, a lot of people, doctors, are now actually leaving the American Medical Association because they said, we actually wanted to become a doctor to help people. And that's not, we find the American Medical Association, by calling any kind of helping people socialized medicine, is not our ideal. We just feel a little bit uncomfortable in serving as vehicles for Wall Street companies to buy our practice, or to pharmaceutical companies or hospitals, all to make money off what we're doing, when the fact is, it's we know that it's lawyers that are determining how we treat people. We're not treating people as doctors. We're treating people, like you said, is give them every kind of test that you can, so that nobody will be able to sue them for malpractice. It's a legalized profession, and all of a sudden, the whole idea of healthcare in this country has very little to do either with medicine or with health, because if it did, you wouldn't have the kind of foods that are sold, you wouldn't have the kind of lifestyle that's promoted here. You'd have a healthier lifestyle, but a healthier lifestyle would cut GDP.
I agree. The trouble is, Michael, we're looking at a country divided. We don't have a 1%. We have an uber-rich 0.01%. We have about a little over 1,400 individuals that are wealthy beyond imagination. But then we have a very prosperous multimillionaire class, and we have a prosperous 17 million professional class. And if they're not wealthy by saving money, they're certainly wealthy by what they buy and property, etc. So when you add in their family members, you're dealing with approximately 70 million Americans are going to be comfortable no matter what happens. But that, okay, that's not 1%. You know, that was a nice idea. 1% is responsible. No, it's in the neighborhood of around 20% of the American population, more or less 15 to 20%, are contributing to making everyone else feel something's wrong with them if they can't live at a certain artificial standard. So we're in a mess, and we've got to stop spending money we don't have. We have to challenge our government to stop spending money they don't have. And as you said, the government cannot go broke, because it can always pay by having the Federal Reserve print money, and then the Secretary of the Treasury decides who's going to get that money. As you said, it's the banks and companies that already have money, just making them richer. We have a mess, and it's not going to be figured out by any of the pundits that I've seen on the networks talking about economics. You, however, you bring a different insight to this, and I appreciate what you're doing. We're out of time, Michael. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks a lot. It was a good discussion, Gary.
Michael Hudson, Professor Michael Hudson. I'm Gary Knoll for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening, and have a nice day.